last night at 5 o'clock, my daughter breezed in from California on an affair, and she brought her little son with her, little grandson. This morning, he's watching cartoons, naturally. And naturally, it's monsters and Superman, good guys against bad guys. The good guys are 100% good. The bad guys are 100% bad. The bad guys are bad because they're fighting the good guys. And the good guys are good because they're fighting the bad guys. That's the only reason that's ever given. Well, that's the story of the Jaredites, isn't it? The good guys and the bad guys fighting, but there are no between. We'll see more of that here. Now, some things here. We saw that they went from sea to sea. And remember, bear in mind that these people aren't of Israel. This is long before there's any Israel or anything else. This is blank humanity. Race is all mixed up. They came from the tower where everything's mixed up. There's no race, there's no religion or anything here, and yet this is the most deeply religious book of the Book of Mormon. You get somebody like the brother of Jared. What's the difference between them here? There are two religions in antiquity. There are two religions always. Wherever you go, you'll always find the two. They're just the two attitudes. The Orphic mysteries explain them. There you have your two fountains, the two springs. On the left hand, you have the spring of Lethe, the spring of forgetfulness. Things pass away, and that's that. And the other is mnemosyne, or anamnesis, as Plato calls it. The difference between remembering and forgetting. The one religion says the best thing you can have is forgetting. Die and get it all over with. A person is best that we were not born, and so forth. And so this is typical of the Romans. You see, where death is, we are not. Where we are, death is not. Maelesbia, Amamus, Amamus, Vivamus Atramamus, Sole Sicidere, et Redire Possunt. The sun goes down, the sun comes up again. Nobis semicum, okay, it looks. But one time our sun has gone down. Una est nox perpetua dormienda. There's nothing but one black night of nothing. So that's what we have to look for. Therefore, the conclusion is, therefore, dami humila basa. Let's get as much sex as we can while we can, and that's about it, you see. But this you find everywhere. You find it in Egypt and everywhere else. On the other hand, there is the doctrine of mnemosyne, that memory is the greatest thing. That once and it's always there. You'll never be able to get. Rid of it. You see, without it, the anthropic system. Without me, the universe is defective. I'm dependent on it, but it is also dependent on me. You see, there's something definitely missing. Our civilization. We're taking the position that there's too much life. Remember, the only solution to the Lamanite problem. The Poland's in the air. Thank you, so hoarse you can hardly talk. The Lamanite problem is to get rid of the Lamanites. Remember, we will go up against them and cut them off from the face of the earth. That's our solution, you see. The same way all through the Book of Mormon. And like the citizens of Antioch, there are too many people in the world. If everybody in Antioch was killed in an earthquake, I'd be the richest man in the city, and that's what he wants to happen, and so forth. And so we kill a gook for God, we say. Deus vult. We have to get rid of many enemies as possible. That's the god of wars. And that's what we're devoted to, more or less, today. Keep population down. The funny thing is, the population is not a problem at all, from a certain point of view. But the Christ came to say that I come to bring them life, that they may have it more abundantly. See, I am the resurrection and the life. Not just the life, but the resurrection. Keep it going forever. And the idea that once it's there forever. This idea of mnemosyne, you'll never be able to forget, you'll never be able to stop. The Book of Mormon teaches us this. But here we're dealing with these rough, tough people, the Jaredites. And they crossed the sea, the Great Sea, which shows they were going west, east over Asia, the great central plains of Asia, which were flooded at the end of the last ice age. Everybody agrees on that. And they dwelt in tents, and then the Promised Land. The Promised Land is not a doctrine peculiar to Israel at all. Not at all. When the great Yadin was here, a little group of us met one night, we were talking about, what is your religion, he says. He says, we don't believe in miracles, but we count on them. We said, then what do you believe in? I believe in the land, the Promised Land. That's my religion. But all these people that were driven out, they all talk about the Promised Land. That's the theme of the Greek lyric poets. They begin the period, the wandering poets, they're always looking for a promised land, whether it's in Egypt or anywhere else. They're always looking for is not utopia, but they're always looking for the land that was lost, the lost Eden, the paradise, the golden age. Every one of them is obsessed with that idea. There's a lost, a golden land, they're going to look for it again. So the Lord gives to Ether, the brother of Jared, he gives what he calls his thoughts on the subject of the promised land. And of course, the same thoughts are those that you find in the Book of Mormon with Israel and with the Nephites. Of course, and we have it here in the third chapter. And it's the usual thing. This is a land of promise. Whatsoever nation shall possess it shall be swept off, and the fullness of his wrath comes. And the fullness of his wrath cometh when they are ripened in iniquity. You notice it's when the cup is full. He uses both expressions here, fullness and ripeness here. He says the same thing in the 8th verse. And then he says again in the 10th verse. It shall be swept off, for it is everlasting decree of God, and it is not until the fullness of iniquity that the children of the land are swept off. See, the preceding verse he called it ripeness. When the fruit is ripe, there's no point to letting it get riper. It'll just rot. The 10th is, when the cup is full, you can't dilute it anymore. You just got to throw it out. It is not until the fullness of iniquity among the children. So he's going to hold out until the very end. Well, how far have we got to go? And this comes to you, O ye Gentiles. This is being addressed to the Gentiles. See, the story of Ether is the story of people that were never heard of the gospel. But they did, after all. They had it down from Noah. O ye Gentiles, and not continue in your iniquities, as you have been doing in the past. And then it talks about the freedom. And then they crossed the great sea, and they dwelt in their tents. And he says, my spirit will not always strive with man. These are my thoughts upon the land which I have given you as an inheritance. Then comes this thing about the boats and the lighting of the boats and so forth. This has caused more merriment and mockery than any other aspect of the Book of Mormon. So we'll refer to it quickly here. Yes, this is according to J.C. Bennett. You know, this is the famous Dr. Bennett, J.C. Bennett. The book of the story of the Jaredites was the climax of all Joseph Smith's indiscretions, in which he used his utmost endeavors to see how far he could impose upon. Now, this is J.C. Bennett, who was once mayor of Nauvoo, and Joseph chose him for a counselor. And he says, who used his utmost endeavors to see how far he could go, he could impose on the gullibility of mankind. It would be useless to make any further comment to prove the absurdities of this extraordinary book than the story of the Jaredites. And then Taylor in 1857 says, this story is nothing less than a libel on the wisdom of God. It seems impossible, another investigator says, for sensible men to credit such trash. My soul is filled with disgust at this monstrous absurdity. We're talking about Jaredite and ships, you see. This is the Reverend C. Fenrick Ward as he perused the pages of Ether. I dare not trust myself to comment on it. The incredible things in this incredible book Of the incredible things in this incredible book, says H.C. Sheldon, no item, perhaps, more fantastic than that which recounts the voyage of the Jaredites to America in very peculiarly constructed barges. Anyone who can believe this story ought to feel obliged to challenge the historicity of any marvelous tales of Alice in Wonderland. In 1956, as late as that, Mr. Biederwolf finds the fantastic story of the passage of the Jaredites to America, one of the tales of Baron Munchausen and Alice in Wonderland, are certainly put to the shade. Well, first about the ships, an important clue to the ships is that Lord tells us in 6 and 7 that they are built on the same pattern as Noah's Ark. Now, we have to get Noah's Ark from the Bible, you never get a picture of what it was like. You have a big block. I gave the publishers here a beautiful old 16th century engraving I had of Noah's Ark. So utterly fantastic. But we have the Babylonian account in the First Kingdom, and then you have the Sumerian account discovered by Hillcrest. Goes way back. We have two very old accounts of the story of Utnapishtim, of the flood story, and they describe the Ark. And it's a very good description. And it matches the ships that Jared made very closely. And we won't spend much time on it, but it's an interesting thing. They were built on the same pattern. Well, that's the clue. See, we built them like Noah's Ark. And what was Noah's Ark like? Why don't the critics laugh their heads off at the Ark? And we now know what it looked like. Can these non-biblical documents really tell us? Of course they can. 100 years ago, Layard unearthed, 1856, in the library of Esarhaddon at Nineveh, he unearthed what was then the oldest library in the world. It was this 7th century BC library from King Anubhasipal, 7th, 8th centuries. And it had the story of the flood in it. And so everybody immediately said, well, here's the original of the Bible flood story. This is where the Jews got it from. See, that just shows the Bible is just a collection of old legends. And then University of Pennsylvania was going to spend, just before World War I, was going to spend a mint to go over and look for an older story in the Sumerian ruins to find an earlier version. The war broke out and they couldn't go, so they had to search what they already had in the library, and there it was, right on top of the pile, the thing they were going to spend $1 million to find they'd had in the library all the time. See, once these things are found, the archaeologists lose interest in them. They've got to go and dig up something else. That's the adventure. But there it was, and it goes back 2100 BC. It's a nice story of the flood there, and it gives a very good description of the ark. And again, we have, you can compare it with the Jaredite ships, the primal version of the story we're called. Well, it was called a Magar boat, the Ark of Nepishtim. Now, here are the qualifications that Ether gives, Ether 216. They were built after the manner of the barges they have hitherto built. Except for some particular, these boats were not new sign, but they'd been built according to a familiar pattern that the people understood and knew something about. There really were such boats. And they were built according to the instructions of the Lord. And they were exceedingly tight, even that they would hold water like unto a dish. The bottom thereof was tight like unto a dish. The sides thereof were tight like unto a dish. Submarine, because remember, the waves are going to dash over them many times. And the ends thereof were peaked. That's a very important thing with a Magar boat. You see why, the reason for that, the oldest boats. We have, well, pre-dynastic pictures of these from the Delta of Egypt. We have pre-dynastic pictures of these boats, and they have, for a very obvious reason, they're peaked, they go this way. These ones were invading Egypt from Mesopotamia, they're like this. It means they couldn't turn turtle. These were floats here. It could go over on its side for a moment, and it would always right itself. It was as good as having a keel here. And the ends thereof were peaked. And the top thereof was tight like unto a dish, a tight deck, in other words. The length thereof was the length of a tree. There wasn't to be too many seams in it. There were some pretty tall trees in those days. But they were small. They were light on the water like unto the lightness of fowls on the water. They bounced around. Boy, this was something to get seasick in. We're told they did get terribly seasick. And the door thereof, when it was shut, was tight like unto a dish. So they had the hatches, and you cut them down, and the water couldn't get into the boat. But how could you breathe when you were inside? Well, this is the problem, you see. And believe it or not, the editors, especially Brother Talmage, very officiously changed the reading of the first edition, of Joseph Smith's first edition. It gives a different picture of how this thing worked. We'll mention that a little later. And then, ye shall be as a whale in the midst of the sea, for the mountain waves shall dash upon you. And their flocks and their herds, oh boy, this to make it something, isn't it? Their flocks and their herds, whatsoever beasts or animals or fowl they should carry with them, got aboard their vessels or barges. And, this is all in the 6th chapter, the Lord caused there to be a furious wind. They were tossed upon the waves of the sea before the wind. The wind did never cease to blow, 344 days, and thus they were driven before the wind. And there were many times buried in the depths of the sea. They were buried in the deep. There was no water that could hurt them. Their vessel was tight like unto a dish, and also tight like unto the ark of Noah. No monster of the sea could break them, neither whale could mar them. And you can be sure that the North Pacific was quite full of whales in those days. No whale could mar them. That was quite a thing. Now let's match each of these 12 points with the Magar boat that Utnapishtim built to survive the flood. Not trusting our own interpretation, we'll quote Hilprecht throughout. The class of boats, according to the Nipper version, the oldest version, were in use already before the deluge, so they were familiar. In the historic times, it still survived in the archaic vessels used in ritual, the great boats in which they would visit each other in their temples during certain festivals. Then, second, all three versions of the deluge story, Utnapishtim received special instructions concerning the construction of a roof or a deck on the boat. And that's why it's called an ark, a tebet. See, an ark is a closed box. And, of course, the Hebrew word tebet is the Egyptian word debet, which is, it means boat or deck, covered with a deck. It means box. Tebet means a box or an ark. And see, the ark is described as a box. And why do they use the same word for the ark as the Ark of the Covenant? Because they were both boxes. So that's why they have such a hard time describing the ark, because it was a box. Can you imagine floating around in a box? Well, it means it had a covered top. It was closed tight. all three versions, special instructions concerning the construction of the boat. And he received these instructions by speaking with the Lord through the veil. By the wall at my left hand, by the wall of the Lord, I will speak unto thee, my pure one, my wise one. Our hand, a deluge, shall be caused. The seed of mankind shall be destroyed. He gave him instructions, it says, through the tekinu, through the kikisu, which was a woven screen in the temple. Well, thirdly, there was a ship. Of course, a solid part, strong enough to carry heavy freight and resist the force of waves and storm. Jensen explains the matu. It's called a matu, or deluge boat. It couldn't capsize. He added, it was seen from the side, it probably resembled a crescent moon. Moreover, the representations of seagoing vessels of the Tyrians and Sidonians show certain class of boats really had such a shape. But the next point is, the principal distinction of the feature of the magor boat was a roof or deck of the boat. In the biblical, as in the Babylonian version, great stress is laid upon preparation of a proper roof or cover. A cover with a strong deck, the Nineveh version says. With a deck as strong as the earth, the second Nineveh version says. Let the deck be strong like the vault of heaven above. This emphasis on the tightness and strength is very important, see. Then, lines containing brief statement of the measure of the ark have been effaced by in the Nineveh version. We don't know how big they were. It says simply, its measures be in proportion, its width and length shall correspond. But they only built one ark, you see. Furthermore, in the first Nineveh version, the boat had a door which was shut during the storm flood. Well, we see that in the same thing with ears. The various names of the boat designate it as that which is closed by a door, practically a houseboat. In Hebrew, the story by an Egyptian word, teva, which means ark, originally a box, chest, coffin, something's closed, an essential part of which is a cover or lid. Eighth, the boat had a door to be shut during the storm flood, and at least one air hole or window. And napishu means air hole, breathage. Nafasha means to breathe. Nefs is Arabic word, nafash is to breathe, of course. Nefesh, the Holy Ghost. Nefisha, spirit. And so it had an air hole. The word nafashu means a breather or ventilator. It doesn't occur to a window. It doesn't apply to a window at all, it says. And that's the word we use in the Book of Ether, too, where it says they unstop when they shall. Well, we'll see what it is. The vessel built by Utnapishtim, being such a houseboat or magor, this word could subsequently be rendered ideographically as matu, deluge boat, magor boat, houseboat, in which gods, men, and beasts live comfortably protected against the waves washing overboard, the driving rain from above against the inclemencies of weather, wind and weather. The fact that the magor boat was to be built was to be completely submerged gives strong support for this, it says. In the magor boat, quote, men and beasts live comfortably. In the second Nineveh version, is take the domestic animals of the field with wild beasts in the field as many as you will. Of course, that's the whole story of Noah's. This is the ark. He got all the animals in. He got a lot more animals than the Jaredites got. With wild beasts, feed as many as eat grass. The Nineveh version mentions beasts of the field, birds of the heaven. C.S. Kuhn, writing in the earliest water transportation, says, dogs howled, pigs grunted, cocks crowed on these seagoing barnyards. The idea that the oldest sailing vessels may have been built for a specific purpose of transporting men and animals together, often for vast distances, seems strange to us. But the Adriatic river boats mentioned in point one keep the whole household afloat for months with their animal and poultry, an idea which, like the riding of buffalo, seems utterly strange to us. And the storm winds, is the Babylonian version. The storm winds with exceeding terror, all of them together raced along with the deluge. The mighty tempest raged with them, and the mighty ship over the great waters the storm wind had tossed. Thus the Sumerian version. Jensen explains the matu is a deluge boat. It's driven by the wind. It's not a sailing vessel. There are no sails ever mentioned. They don't need to be, you see. Though driven by the storm, it had, quote, nothing in common with a boat in full sail, and nowhere is a sail mentioned. Nor would it have been of much use, been rent to shreds in a minute. They were driven before the wind all the way, these fierce winds. Notice they both say exactly what the Book of Ether says. It matches. I mean, we don't need to question this thing as the absurdest thing ever written anymore, you see. It was nowhere is a sail mentioned, says Helprecht. Nor would it have been of much use in such a hurricane as described. Besides, we observe that the pictures of the Tyrian boats referred to have no sails. Magor boat was driven by the wind, but not with sails. And finally, 12, it shall be a houseboat carrying what is saved of life, and its purpose being to preserve life and full protection against the waves washing overboard. Now, there is the, that being about the air hole, you know, that has been changed, as I said, by some. And in the Jensen explains here. The deluge boat, not because it was a sailing boat driven by the wind, but rather a hurricane boat, a bubu shubtu, but because it possessed certain qualities which rendered it especially effective during the deluge, when its exclusive purpose was to carry the remains of life and to protect man and beast against the water. It's not the one I was looking for. That's right back here. Oh, here we are. And the Lord said to the brother of Jared, thou shalt make a hole in the top thereof, and also in the bottom thereof. And thou shalt suffer the air. When thou shalt suffer for air, thou shalt unstop the hole. There, it doesn't say open the window. You shall unstop a hole. It's a very different thing from open. It talks about opening windows, but this is something. There's a hole in the top. What is this? An air compressor they've got. Yeah? Something a hole to compress air. Thou shalt unstop the hole thereof and receive air. And if it so be that the water come in upon thee, behold, you shall stop the hole thereof, that she may not perish in the flood. And then, notice the hole thereof, the hole of the water. And there's the hole of the air and the hole of the water, that you may not perish in the flood. An exacting editor, by removing the very significant thereofs, when we say receive air, when you suffer from air, you unstop the hole thereof. That means air hole, you see, and receive air. See, that way. But he removed the air and the thereof, and he said, when you suffer from the air, you shall unstop the hole and receive air. And he hasn't mentioned thereof, which means, of course, air hole. Made it to appear that when Jared wanted air, he had to open the top window of the boat to admit fresh air, but that's the very time he had to keep it closed. Well, they didn't have air inside, they had to keep it closed because the waves were dashing outside. You had to keep it closed then. That was not what the original of the Book of Mormon says. For one thing, the ships had no windows communicating with the outside. You cannot have windows, you see. Each ship had an airtight door, we're told, and that was all. Air was received not by opening and closing doors and windows. Only, it says, when they were quiet and riding on the surface, then they could open the window and replenish the air. But he says, but by unplugging air holes, thou shalt unstop the hole thereof and receive air. This being done only when the ship was not on the surface, when thou shalt suffer for air. That is, when the ships were not able to open the hatches and replenish their air, something like this. Well, this can only refer to a reserve supply of air, and indeed the brother of Jared recognizes that the people cannot possibly survive on the air contained within the ships at normal pressure. We shall perish, for in them we cannot breathe, save it be the air which is in them. Therefore we shall perish. So the Lord recommended a device for trapping, compressing air with a hole in the top thereof and also in the bottom thereof. Not referring to the ship, but to the air chamber as well. Again, the peculiar language, unstop an air hole. When thou shalt suffer for air, thou shalt unstop the hole thereof and receive air. When the crew found it impossible to remain on the surface, and if so, that the water come upon thee, there to plug up the air chamber. You shall stop up the hole thereof, that you may not perish, to keep the air after you have replenished. And so it goes. But anyway, much more important than that is the conversation the Lord has with Brother Enoch on the subject of light. We shall not get light. When he's told how to build them and so forth, and he says, in the second chapter already, still in the second chapter, Lord, I have performed the work which thou hast commanded me, and I have made the barges according as thou hast directed me. But there's something wrong. O Lord, in them there is no light. Whither shall we steer? And we shall perish, for in them we cannot breathe, save it is the air which is in them. They know that, you see, therefore we shall perish. And then the Lord gives the instructions here, which have been changed in our book, you see, unstop the hole and so forth. They have a compressor. We cannot have windows, for they should be dashed in pieces. Neither shall we take fire. The Lord tells them you can't have windows for light, and you can't take fire. That's interesting. It uses up all the oxygen. It's out of the question, you see. For you shall not go by the light of fire. Behold, you shall be as a whale in the midst of the sea. So what will you do? And the winds which I have caused to gone forth in the floods, what will ye that I should prepare? So the brother of Jared says, what will we do for air? And the Lord always answers in this way, well, what ideas do you have on the subject? He must contribute. That's the whole idea. After all, the whole company could have been taken through the air across the Pacific just like that. That wasn't the idea. You all have to go through this. And so he asked the brother of Jared, well, what ideas have you got on the subject? What will ye that I should prepare for you, that you may have light when you're swallowed up in the depths of the sea? Well, he had an idea. Jared, now the number of the vessels had been prepared was 8. He went forth unto the mount. It was called Shalom. Shalom means high, safe, secure. The word Shalom is derived from that. Remember, Shalom means you're safe. If you're Shalom, Shulam is a ladder, a high place, you see. So if you're going to a high place, and it is a safe place, secure place, a Shulam. And he goes to the highest mountain around. And Moses does the same thing. Lehi, Nephi does the same thing. So again, this is a pattern. And he melted out 16 stones. Well, how did he know how to do that? Because the Ark of Noah was lit by stones, by shining stones, what the Lord had blessed. That's how he knew about it. It says it was constructed after the manner of Noah's Ark. So when the Lord asked, well, what do you want me to do? Ah, I'll get some shining stones. See that? They were white and clear, even as transparent glass. But alas, they wouldn't shine. That was the trouble. They didn't shine in the dark. There's another problem. So what does he do? This is very symbolic, too. He climbs the highest mountain around. He did carry up in his hands to the top of the mountain. He stood on the top of the mountain and said, Lord, this is where I get off. This is as far as I go. And he holds them up and says, you've got to do something now. I've done everything in my power. And then he suggests to the Lord, what you do, touch these and make them shine, then everything will be all right. But the way he puts it, he's not laying down commands to the Lord or anything. He is reduced to the depths of humility now. Of all the humble requests we have in all of Scripture, this is the most profound. This really goes, he talk about a man in humility. The need is urgent now. And so, the Jaredites, they discover their limitations. He says, Lord, don't be angry with me, with thy servant, because of his weakness. We know thou art holy and dwellest in the heavens. We are unworthy before thee. Because of the fall, our natures have become evil continually. Nevertheless, O Lord, thou hast given us a commandment that we must call upon thee, that from thee we may receive according to our desires. Anything you want, you ask the Lord for, and you have a right to do that. You've been commanded to do it. O Lord, thou hast smitten us because of our iniquity. Thou hast driven us forth these many years we have been in the wilderness. How eloquent the man is. Nevertheless, thou hast been merciful unto us. Oh, look upon me in pity, and turn away thine anger from this thy people. Suffer not that they shall go forth across the raging deep in darkness, but behold, these things which I have molten out of the rock, these little pretty things, I don't mean a thing, he calls them these things, rather contemptuously. I know, Lord, that thou hast all power and can do whatsoever thou wilt for the benefit of man. Therefore, touch these stones that they may shine forth in the darkness, and they shall shine forth unto us in the vessels which we have prepared. So the Lord stretches forth his hand and touches the stones with his finger. And the veil was taken from the eyes of the brother Jared, and he saw the finger of the Lord and was knocked flat. The finger of man like unto the finger of a man, like flesh and blood, like unto flesh and blood. Of course, the Lord does not have flesh and blood, you know. Flesh is of this earth, blood is the corruptible part of our nature. And the brother of Jared fell down before the Lord. It's not fat. The Lord says, why have you fallen? I knew not that the Lord had flesh and blood. And the Lord said unto him, now this is a crux. Just within the last week, there's something come out. I don't know. I think it was in the student review or somebody says there is a flat contradiction in the Book of Mormon where he tells him, no man has seen me before. He tells him, never have I shown myself unto man whom I have created, for never has man believed as thou hast believed. But he'd already showed himself to Adam. No, he hadn't. He hadn't showed himself to Adam in the flesh. He showed himself to Adam before the fall. After, he didn't show himself to Adam, remember? And Adam, before the fall, was not a body of flesh and blood. He was not perishable. He was immortal. So here we have, as I shall take upon me flesh and blood. Well, the Lord did, because so he should suffer, be crucified, and died. As we know, the blood is the life, the earthly life, the corruptible element, and flesh is itself of the substance of the earth. Flesh is basar, is the perishable and corruptible. So he says, I shall take upon me flesh and blood, which he was to do, you see. And he says, sawest thou more than this? He answered, nay. And he said, the Lord, truly I know thou speakest. And then the Lord showed himself unto him as he was. And says, therefore, ye are redeemed and taken back into my presence. There's the pre-existence again, you see. Behold, I am he who was prepared from the foundation of the world. I am Jesus Christ, he said, the Father and the Son. Notice in the same verse he says, all who believe in my name become my sons and my daughters. Well, if he has sons and daughters, of course the Father. And he is the Son also. The Father and the Son. And then never have I showed myself unto man whom I have created. See, Adam in the garden was eternal. He was not immortal. The first time he showed his immortal body to a mortal man. That's what this was, yes?
What about what? In the Book of Moses, it seems to indicate that Enoch was shown Christ as well.
That Enoch saw the Lord? No. He was carried away in a vision. He was carried away to heaven. Enoch only saw him when he, remember when the lights go down? And then he finds himself lying upon the earth in the dark. He hadn't been talking to the Lord here. He'd been in the other world. He'd been in his presence up in the celestial kingdom, just as Lehi had. Remember at the beginning, Lehi, he says, he saw God sitting on his throne, surrounding by a numerous concourse of angels, and then they all went on a conference. See, it's the time element here. This was the great council in heaven he was seeing when the decision was made and so forth. So he had to go there to see him. Yes, you won't see God in the flesh and live. We're told that very clearly, you see, in the Pearl of Great Price and the book of Moses. No man can stand in his presence and live. And the same thing. But this was a special case given to the brother of Enoch. Well, he's supposed to write these things. But notice, in the same body, even as he showed himself to the Nephites, he showed himself to the Nephites how? After the resurrection. And he was no longer flesh and blood. So all the fuss about this. Now the polarization. There's something else we... Oh, yes, the rocks. I want to talk, because the time is limited, about this polarization. We've been talking about that. We've been talking about that all along, haven't we? Faith no longer, but nevertheless, there's some things here. What did I have here? Well, it mentions elephants. You notice that elephants are never mentioned in connection with the Nephites, just with the Jaredites. Just in the very early days, you find them on the continent. And they were used, and they're easily tamed, as you know, in India. And how did they cross the waters, the sixth chapter? How would they endure those terrible situations? They said, we had sing-ins. We just sang all day long and enjoyed it, you see. I was 30 days crossing the Atlantic on one occasion, and the only way we could possibly endured was to sing all day, as he's singing. Notice, and it came to pass the wind did never cease to blow toward the promised land while they were upon the waters, and thus they were driven before the wind. And they did sing praises unto the Lord. Yea, the brother of Jared did sing praises unto the Lord, and they did thank and praise the Lord all the day long. And when the night came, they did not cease to praise the Lord. That's how they lived through it. They had these super sing-ins. It can be quite invigorating, you know, to keep on. And we have Moroni's commentary here. And the works done in prison, that's a very interesting thing, because that's so characteristic of the Asiatic society. But we were talking about this Asiatic society, this knockdown and drag out, the very sort of ninjo or something, turtles that my little grandson was looking at this morning. There's always good guys against good guys, bad guys, and you always have them, and you'll always have equals against each other, and you'll never solve that terrible thing. And how this works, I give an example here. In the 4th century, St. Basil is writing about it in his century. In the confused political situation, he says, everybody wants to give orders and nobody wants to take them. Men are willing to cooperate on anything only as the most effective means of crippling a common enemy, after which they turn against each other. The final survivor disputed number one was Constantine the Great. This was in Antioch too, remember, the city where everybody wanted to be wiped out so I'd be the richest man left. The final survivor and undisputed number one was Constantine the Great. He interrupted and made him stop fighting. But, to quote our own study on the subject, no sooner had Constantine removed this last civil and military liberty between the civil and military opponents than the issue between the Christians and pagan subjects became acute. He had to settle that, so he settled that. He put the pagans in their place, and then the churchmen started accusing each other of heresy, and wild abandon that surpassed, then it has to be Arius against Athanasius. The whole Christian world is then split again. Then the emperor takes sides, comes down with one side, and removed the last heretic, he said, and received the undying thanks of the church. The true believers were at each other's throats as never before. And so this is the way it goes. And this, nowhere is this process more sharply brought into focus than Moroni's inserts in his father's book and his own on the supreme results of polarizing here. Here the Jaredite business and something here. Now, this is a very important principle, that the two poles conceive an ever greater antipathy to each other. The more they're alike, the more they come to be alike. Everyone knows that like poles repel each other and only opposite poles attract each other. And it was the custom of the emperors, now we're talking about right from the beginning, as soon as Trajan and Hadrian took over and took all half of Asia and so forth, then the trouble began, the two worlds fighting each other. Well, it was very old. Of course, it goes back much older than that. It goes back to Battle of Thermopylae. It goes much older than that. It's always been going on. The emperors of the East and West fighting each other. The emperors, in this case, of Roman Asia. I have particularly Justinian and Chosroes in mind. both very powerful emperors, a revived empire. The emperors of Rome and Asia describe themselves in absolutely identical terms, while each accuses his rival of being nothing but a base forgery and depraved imitation of himself. This is not a real clash of ideologies at all, but only a rivalry of parties animated by identical principles, have the same objectives. What they're both after is the Book of Mormon, formula of power and gain. And the secret of commanding loyalty on both sides was, of course, to play up the wickedness of the other. The empire of the 4th century was, this is when Rome collapsed, you see, and was its very strongest, biggest army and everything else. The empire of the 4th century was a world of displaced persons, inevitably drawn toward the big city. Just in the last 2 months, Cairo's gone up another million. There are now 15 million people living in Cairo. Inevitably drawn toward the big city. To take place of the old lost loyalty to hearth and homeland, a prisca fides, a primitive belief and faith, strong measures had to be taken. New super loyalty was needed to guarantee the permanence of the social order. Men were taught to declare allegiance to a super thing, a noble abstraction loosely designated as Romania or Romanitas, the binding cement which was carefully cultivated in hostility to barbarian. We're the Romans, they're the barbarians. Well, same with the Babylonians. Same with the Muslims. Agar Pacatus, Agar Hosticus with the Romans, Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb. And you see that's being very strongly emphasized. You're never going to come to agreement with the Iranians or the Iraqis as long as they say Dar al-Harb, though Islam means to submit. All those who have submitted are, and it means peace also, Salam. Dar al-Islam, all who have submitted are the real people. And all outside is the Dar al-Harb. And they threaten us. They're always being threatened. So that's why the emperor expanded. They couldn't stand anyone beyond their borders but threatening them. Remember the last line of the great fourth eclogue that got Virgil made a saint. Pacatum curiget patriis virtutibus orbem. The emperor must inevitably rule over a pacified, or there's Islam, pacatum agar pacatus, pacatum curiget. He must race over a pacified earth. All the earth must be pacified under his rule according to patriis virtutibus, according to the virtues of our virtuous ancestors. We're the virtuous people, and we're doomed. We must rule the earth because we're the good guys. And Barbaria is the threatening world of the steppes of Asia. It's no more a fiction of government propaganda. It was real and intimate. There was real such a contrast. It was the age-long struggle, this is quoting J.B. Bury, to repel, check, or annihilate a perennial enemy. He says, the eternal question, the strife between Europe and Asia, between East and West, between Aryan and non-Aryan, all around the civilized periphery of Asia, the horrors of the heartland had for centuries been dealt with in the same way. I talked about geopolitics, the basic driving mechanism of history. Remembering that the weather is always the thing that gets things moving, always, and of course it is in the Book of Ether too. Remember the terrible winds, the towers destroyed, these terrible winds, the Burans never ceased to blow. The hordes of the heartland had for centuries dealt with in the same way, by subtle and disruptive diplomacy, by long and costly limas, those are lines, walls, by punitive deterrent expeditions when all else failed, by the reluctant absorption of their barbarian conquerors. Omar. Well, this is interesting. I might as well conclude it, too. To command loyalty became part of the public education policy. To the lessons of the schools, carefully supervised by the government, was added a more aggressive policy of deliberately widening the gulf between the two worlds, planned polarization. For centuries, barbarian and Roman, East and West, had been mingling on terms of the greatest intimacy, producing a borderline culture which was quite impossible to draw the line between one culture and the other. Priscus, who was sent back in the 6th century, remembers quite casually the presence of people from the West visiting relatives in the camps of the Asiatics. He notes the busy coming and going of merchants between the two worlds. He describes the kind hospitality shown him, a complete stranger in the home of the Easterners. But with this, he gives us the other side of the picture, the official side, the ubiquitous activity of spies and agents in Roman pay, the infusion into the very court of Attila of large sums of Roman money to corrupt and divide, the insane mounting conviction of the rulers of the two halves of the world, both barbarians each, that his was the divine calling to liberate the human race from the intolerable ambition of the other. The Jaredite and Roman examples before us return to the two most notable exponents. And so the thing is, it still is going on today. That's right. I'm quoting from two books here. You may recognize the one. It seems melodramatic, writes the first author, to treat the two poles of human experience, who are very important, man. Experience represented by the United States and Soviet Union, and this talk was given 10 years ago, as the equivalent of good and evil, light and darkness, God and the devil. Yet if we allow ourselves to think of them that way, even hypothetically, it can help clarify our perspective of the world's struggle. It hardly clarifies the picture, it certainly simplifies it, as he continues. The United States represents hope, freedom, security, and peace. The Soviet Union stands for fear, tyranny, aggression, and war. If these are not poles, good and evil in human affairs, then the concept of good and evil have no meaning. Those who cannot see the distinction have little claim to lecture on conscience. So there you have it. They're just two poles. And strange things, we have to do exactly what they do. We have to react. Every time we don't act, we react. That's what Satan does. He has to react. All his power is to destroy. He can lie, but after a statement has been made. And all the things he does the four things that Joseph Smith said we must never do under any circumstances, namely accuse. See, Satan is diabolus. Devil means accuser. He's the accuser of his brethren, the scripture calls. Never accuse. You must never aspire. First of all, never aspire. Joseph said Satan aspired, and that was his undoing. He aspired to greatness. You must never contend. The first rule to the Nephites was, there shall be no more contentions among you, as there have been in the past, for all contention is of the devil, and you must never coerce. You must never force. And that's the way the devil works. But that's always reacting to something someone else has done. You never initiate your own doing, you see. And so we have this here. Evil leads, repel us. There are just two poles, and we are all at one pole, and they're all at the other. They're even like the two things in the film this morning. The bad guys are good because they're fighting the bad guys. The bad guys are good just because they're fighting the good guys. That would make them bad, and that's all. That's as far as you need to go. So, their evil deeds repel us. Strange to say, we do everything they do because they force us to. Now, I'm quoting here. Soviet strategy is not defensive. It is designed to secure victory. The only answer for us is a strategy of victory on the Soviet side, is a strategy of victory for the West. If they play dirty, we too can fight the Twilight War in the hazardous mufti of the CIA. While we have been giving our lectures on human rights, no more of that. We now do everything they do. We must fight them because they do all those bad things. And to fight them, we must do all the same bad things, he says. Thus, just like them, and I'm quoting here, we must give up desirable social goals to attain military aims. We have no choice but to counterpose our military strength to that of the Soviet Union's, which of course leaves them no choice but to counter ours. This is the way to avoid defeat, he tells us. Finding ourselves constantly threatened, we should be as much a threat to them as they are to us. Declare ourselves as free to forage on the Soviet side as they have been to forage on ours. The Soviet leaders can be utterly ruthless if they use power. We must do the same. Only if the West develops a sense of purpose equal to theirs, though different from theirs, how different is it? Well, we go on here and so forth. An equal is, by their definition, a rival. No reconciliation, no coexistence, no avoidance of war is to be thought of, because they will not allow it. The thesis of Mr. Nixon's book, if not this life, if not his life, is that we are constantly being threatened, and that there's only one way to meet the threat coming as it does from the source of irredeemable evil, etc., etc., and that is, now we're quoting, is power. To meet the challenge of our survival, we must drastically increase our military power, shore up our economic power, reinvigorate our will power, strengthen the power of our presidents, and develop a strategy named not just at avoiding defeat, but at attaining victory. Victory requires knowing when to use power. He quotes James M. Burns then, presidents must have a will to power. They must constantly search for power, build it if necessary out of every scrap of formal authority or personal influence they can locate. They must be constantly guard against whatever power they have achieved. They must hoard power so that it will be available in the future. One man alone has the specific responsibility to ensure power, and that, of course, is the president. The effective use of power, that only experience can teach. At this point, naturally, recall what Moses 6:15 says, especially Ether 8:16. Where he says, well, in those days Satan had great dominion among men, raging in their hearts. From their thenceforth came wars and bloodshed because of secret works, teaching for power. He says here, the sine qua non, right here, the sine qua non of the conduct exercise of power is secrecy. He must have secrecy, and so we have here. Moroni saying, remember, he's commenting on, see, from thenceforth came wars and bloodshed because of secret works seeking for power. And then Moses, Ether 8 and 16. Moroni's statement says, talking about, still Moroni talking, see, oaths given by them of old who sought power, and they were kept up by the power of the devil to administer under people to keep them in darkness. There's the secrecy, you see, to help such as sought power to gain power. There's the same part of the secrecy and the power. Look, he says here, to keep them in darkness so that such as sought power could go ahead seeking power. Granted that such power seeking is bad on their side, what else can it be on those who imitate them? Keep them well, and so it goes on. Now, remember what our subject we're writing on is not just war you're talking about. There are very much other things, as you know, various facets. We must talk about that the next time. See, we're getting off. And then we quote others here. But then on the other hand, we quote here, well, he says here, finally, in that short run, Napoleon is wrong when he says it's spirit that always wins. The spirit, he says he's wrong. In the short run, that means so. But we're not living in that kind of a world. The final analysis, victory goes to the side with the power. Power is the ability to make things happen, to set the course of history. Nothing could be more insane. The first law of Clausewitz in the history, classic work on war, the first law of war is uncertainty. You never can tell when the war begins what's going to happen, ever, ever, ever. And he says, yet we have the power, so we can set the course of history. Well, you know who that is speaking. The other one is taught by Solzhenitsyn, and he says the same thing. His teaching is the danger. Nixon says the danger is that we're so different. No, he says the danger isn't that at all, but the danger is that we're so much alike. And then he shows, remember Solzhenitsyn, he tells us he says, I must read this to you. These two great principles of action that dominates, we're both materialistic. We both say the economy is everything. He insists in describing the West, he has also described the East. At first glance, it seems an ugly parallel. Common traits in the thinking of the way of life today, East and West, but such is the logic of materialistic development. This is the real crisis, he says, in the West. He says, in the East, it is destroyed by dealings and machinations of the ruling party. In the West, commercial interests tend to suffocate it. This is the real crisis. The split world is less terrible than the fact that the same disease is plaguing the two main sections. And that's the case. The great empires always fight the great emperors. Democracies always fight the great democracies and so forth. It's always kings against kings, princes against princes, equals fighting equals. That's the very essence of the thing. Even the last World War, two great commercial empires. Buckminster Fuller said that World War I was just a fighting of the sea pirates against the land pirates. The British Empire were the sea pirates. They went out and grabbed anything they wanted, and the Germans were doing the same thing by land. It was a fight against the sea pirates and the land pirates, but they were like as peas in a pod. As you know, they were cousins. The royal families were very close, very intimate, loving families of the Kaiser and Queen Victoria. He was the Kaiser's nephew and so forth and so on. Well, what is the real crisis then? Our Book of Ether is not a waste of paper, believe me. It's nothing to be laughed at, and coming very serious. I guess we'll have to talk about the final the next time, won't we?